Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, I think it was Utah, around 1910, the Ear Wars began. This is Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer, and today we kick off a new series on hearing and the human ear by looking at the controversial history of headphones. And later, the New York composer and tabla player Kersh Kale joins us to talk about the transatlantic collaboration behind his new album. For the next 4 days in our Ear Wars series, we'll explore a battle going on for your ears. And as with any battle, there's always the possibility of casualties. So we'll hear about great new gadgets, but also the possible threat of hearing damage. And we begin with something you might be using right now, headphones. We'll find out in a moment why and how they were invented in the first place. But I'm joined in the studio by Virginia Heffernan, who writes the Medium column for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. She recently wrote about the argument against headphones. And Virginia, headphones perched upon your head, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
So this kind of sparked our whole series. You call for a New Year's resolution to use headphones less. Not to not use them, but to use them less. Why?
I have an aesthetic preference that is not necessarily borne out by the science for sounds in their natural habitat. And we listen to a lot of music and voices in a very rarefied way. We listen to audiobooks and we listen to the radio through headphones. This sound that listeners are hearing right now is very carefully and perfectly engineered for them. And kids listen to a lot of music through headphones, music that's been reported, the signal's been compressed, it's been put into their headphones, and then perfectly engineered to hit their ears in very specific ways. First, the study came out saying 1 in 5 teenagers can't hear, 9 to 12-year-olds even, can't hear the rustling of leaves, they can't hear whispers, they can't hear certain plosive consonants. So a word like talk might sound like awe to them.
Hmm.
Now, the study was careful to say that that's called slight hearing impairment. That's pretty serious to me. And when I heard that, you know, when I thought about not being able to hear whispers and combine that, you know, that the evidence of that study with the idea that we're using headphones and listening to sound in this super engineered, very careful, very it doesn't ask very much of your ears. I realized that there might be something to my aesthetic preference for sounds in their natural habitat, for handling interference with your own ears, making preferences about what's interference, what's signal and what's noise, making decisions about what's signal and what's noise on your own that might be good for your hearing. And ultimately good for your intelligence. And I'm not the only one to connect this demonstrable hearing loss with widespread headphone use, especially earbuds.
Now, let me just ask you, you've mentioned twice already sounds in their natural environment. When we listen to music, recorded music, what's its natural environment? Because most records are made in these kind of antiseptic studios, you know, that don't really give you much of an audio environment.
Yeah. In the early days of recording technology, much was made of the fact that the sound was live, sounded almost live, and then even all the way up to the Memorex, is it live or is it Memorex? On some level, there seems to be some advantage in recapturing a live experience, in fidelity, in some faithfulness to the way things sound in some imagined world where things make the sounds they're supposed to make. If you rub against something, I just hit the mic.
Right.
That makes a rough sound.
It also makes our engineers really mad.
I want to make a sound a little bit that like breaks the frame, this perfect frame, because we're so used to it, and it's nice to hear things out of our usual range. So what is a real, what does the, you know, actual Stravinsky sound like, you know, when it's not the a perfect MP3 recording through headphones? I don't know. I do think sometimes it's worth even letting the interference of the recording technology be part of the experience. So we've all had the, remember getting a mixtape that had just the right recording of Neil Young, but you could hear a click at a particular part. The interest in that song was partly the interest in that click, or partly the interest in the weird way it was recorded.
Well, and I think we've all had the experience of, you know, you listen to a record at a friend's house and it sounds one way, and then when you get a copy and you listen in your house, in your room, or in your basement, or whatever, somehow sounds slightly different. And different rooms will give you different frequency responses.
Yeah, of course. And also having, like, you know, slowly making out the background music is a song that you hadn't thought about in a long time, but you're having to strain to hear it, you know, and you've got conversation going on. That can be a wonderful experience of sound.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Virginia Heffernan. She writes the Medium column for the New York Times Sunday Magazine and has sort of called for us to think twice before putting on the cans, as we call them. What are the studies about headphone use and hearing loss? Because, you know, it seems to me that there's, even within the community of audiologists and scientists, some conflict in the way that a lot of these studies are kind of parsed and the conclusions derived.
The 1 in 5 figure, so for this is slight hearing loss. Again, slight hearing loss means trouble hearing whispers and trouble hearing the rustling of leaves and plinking of raindrops. Those were the examples given. So slight hearing loss in children 1 to 12, that's, we're talking about 20% of the American population of kids those ages. That study does not connect that hearing loss to the use of portable music devices and headphones. That's a separate conclusion drawn only, I think, by a European study of MP3 players that you might be able to detect some hearing loss, inconclusive, and also the sense that we all have that these headphones are ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. I think probably 20 years ago, if we'd seen that same kind of hearing loss, even 30 years ago maybe, we would have blamed it on
Walkman,
and before that on simply tinnitus from listening to loud music at concerts and rooms and so on. It's a slightly different hearing loss than you get from tinnitus, apparently.
Tinnitus, or tinnitus, as the audiologists like to pronounce it,
is something
that we'll get into on Wednesday's edition of Soundcheck in our Ear Wars series. Let me ask you, I mean, for you, Virginia, is this kind of a personal thing to take this on?
It is personal. I went through various cycles with a set of tumors in my left ear, non-cancerous tumors, mastoid infections that were caused by a slightly kind of obscure kind of tumor called cholesteatoma. And after a couple of surgeries, my hearing just kept getting worse. So I've sat through many audiograms, as anyone who's been down an ENT road has, and listened many times to, it's always, for some reason, it's always compound words with an American association. I don't know if anyone who does a lot of audiograms knows, hot dog, baseball. Apple pie. Really is. Those are the words. Anyway.
What is the test? Just that you can hear them and repeat them?
It's just a hearing test. They get quieter and quieter and louder. You lift your hand and you have a slowly sinking feeling because if you're me, some of it's silent. And you know a lot of time is passing. So I started to talk to the people, the audiographers, about things like guessing about the word. You know, you have to repeat it back. So if I guess hot dog, because I've had the test so many times, is that okay? Apparently, it is okay to audiographers because even people with good hearing, everybody's guessing all the time from context. So if I'm able to use the cues of the fact that I've taken this test a lot of times before and I can fill in the sound, then good for me. That counts as hearing, which I thought was very interesting.
Well, that is, I mean, isn't that what our brain is doing anyway? Is processing cues from our environment?
Yeah, it seems like it, and I liked that because I thought that, you know, your auditory experience is not distinct from your experience of language and of culture and of, you know, they couldn't isolate just hearing, and they didn't even want to in the particular audiogram setting.
You take these with headphones on, right?
You take them with headphones on, exactly. Now I'm missing some upper registers in my left ear. It makes it difficult for me to locate sound. I feel sometimes, you know, when my phone rings, I don't know where it is or if it's my phone, and I have trouble with ambient sound. Mm-hmm. But as tempting as it is to, you know, to just get under headphones and just listen to one signal, I somehow feel like that's people in physical therapy, you know, now in physical therapy, the sort of watchword is using lots of muscle groups at once instead of isolating muscle groups. So I'm trying to make myself more alert to cues, hearing cues, than less alert. Do you know what I mean? By using a lot of headphones. So listening to things in a club where I can't really hear everything and there's static and there's this and that feels like a challenge. And also, when I can figure it out, a mental pleasure.
So maybe that leads us to this clip of the poet William Carlos Williams. I mean, when you listen to this, are you listening for cues that, I mean, for subtleties of the voice in the room? I mean, what do you listen for here?
I love this clip. It's a very short clip, a short poem, William Carlos Williams reading in 1950. I love it because I heard it as part of a set of recordings of poetry. Almost all of them were made in the studio by actors. So there was Gwyneth Paltrow reading, I can't remember exactly, but there were some of them reading Shakespeare and John Lithgow. And they were perfect recordings. You can imagine they'd done many takes, that they were in a beautiful soundproof room, and that they had perfect audio equipment from 2005. And then in the midst of this was a recording of the poet himself in 1950, reading, I don't know the circumstances under which he's reading, his great simple poem, This Is Just to Say. I played this set of recordings for my five-year-old and some of his friends just to try to get them interested in poetry. They were not very interested in most of the poems, but something about this recording, which sounds so different from everything else on the album because it's a 1950s technology, you can hear room tone, you can hear a little bit of interference. They said they liked that poem the best. Hmm. And the thing, and I thought, it's not warmth, you know, the thing that vinyl fanatics say that they get out of vinyl, warmth. It's something else, and I don't know what it is. I think my mind, too, with this recording, unlike just a recording of a poet, of, you know, an actor reading something perfectly modulated, maybe even a little sweetened in post-production, this has none of that sweetening. As far as I know, this is exact, you know, close to as it was recorded and maybe broadcast in 1950. And something about it lets you connect with it more.
I see what kind of audio cues you get from this little clip of the poet William Carlos Williams in 1950.
This is just to say, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold.
Now, we're sitting here, Virginia, with headphones on, and
yeah.
I can hear through headphones the slight sort of bounce back of his voice off of the wall of the room that he's in. You know, there's that kind of hollow sound.
Is that, that's what you hear?
That's what I'm
okay,
hearing.
Okay, because you know much better than I do what it would be. Hollow is really interesting. So do you like that hollow sound? Does that register as pleasurable?
It just registers as different. It's not a studio recording.
Yeah.
It sounds like a field recording almost. You know, you get a sense of a place. But my question is, I don't know if, you know, if we were just in the control room listening to that clip on speakers, I don't know if I would have gotten that. You know, it's because I'm wearing headphones. There's a kind of, to me, headphones are like to hearing what eyeglasses are to sight. You know,
yeah.
There's a certain acuity that you get with headphones, which could be good or bad, because that same acuity means if you get a blast of feedback, it's really going to set your ears ringing painfully for perhaps quite a while. And that's happened to me too.
There are all these kind of uncanny details in the transition from analog to digital culture. There are people who are great fans of tube television who love the particular colors of a, you know, tube television set, analog television set. But they watch it digitally remade, you know, to get the colors again. So, I mean, it may be that there's, because you're a particular aficionado, you want to hear it under a microscope. But there's, I don't know, but there's something in the original, I mean, this is, as you say, this is a digital recapitulation of a very analog experience. And I think what we're appreciating about it is the analogness of it. Yeah.
We're speaking with Virginia Heffernan, who writes the Medium column for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And listeners, what do you think? Has the use of headphones become too widespread? Are we missing something when we listen to the world literally like a millimeter away from our ears? Or, you know, is this much ado about nothing? Should we just go ahead and use headphones whenever we feel like it? You can give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Does music sound better on headphones? Are you not so concerned about the long-term effects of listening to lots of music on headphones? 212-433-WNYC, or leave a comment online, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And joining us now is Mark Katz. He's professor of music at the University of North Carolina and author of the book Capturing Sound, How Technology Has Changed Music. Mark, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, John.
Has headphone technology changed music?
Well, it certainly has in some ways. The way I would think of it is that listening to music on headphones is just a different experience from listening live. And there are negative aspects of it and there are positive aspects. Negative aspects, well, I mean, listening on headphones while walking in public is a kind of antisocial act. You're telling people basically leave me alone, and it's a kind of it's kind of antisocial behavior. It can also hurt your hearing, as Virginia had pointed out. But on the other hand, it does give you a different experience, and there is music that really is made for headphones, in which you can really experience it in the way it was meant to be heard. In fact, there is music in which headphones are the natural habitat.
Hmm. So the question we asked before about, you know, what is the natural habitat of this music?
Well, give us an example.
Well, sure. There's a lot of music like ambient music, down tempo. There are experimental electronic composers. But actually, there's a lot of music that many of us already know that was certainly created in part with headphones in mind. I'll give you an example that I just thought of this morning, which is Pink Floyd's Brain Damage from Dark Side of the Moon, 1973. Mm-hmm. There's a great part where Roger Waters sings, "The Lunatic is in My Head." And when you hear him sing that, you hear him on both sides of your ear, from both ears. But right after he says that, there's a crazy laugh, and it's mixed so that it comes right in the center. And you swear you hear it in your head. Inside your head, but
only if you're listening on headphones.
You get a sense if you're listening on speakers, but this is really made to be listened to in your head. It's in fact part of the meaning of this song is to experience someone in your head. And in fact, there's a later line that really encapsulates what's both disturbing and great about listening on headphones. It's when Waters sings, "There's someone in my head, and it's not me." And that's basically what listening to headphones is. Hmm. There's someone in your head. It's not you. And either that's terribly disturbing or it's wonderful because you experience a kind of intimacy with this music that you couldn't in any other form.
All right. Well, here's that example that Mark is talking about from the classic Pink Floyd record, Dark Side of the Moon.
And if your head explodes with all the bones too, I'll see you on the dark side of the moon. The lunatic is in my head. The lunatic is in my head. You raise the blade. You make the change. You rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door, throw away the key. There's someone in my head, but it's not me.
Pink Floyd's Brain Damage from the Dark Side of the Moon album, 1973. And as professor and author Mark Katz was just telling us, you hear the song and the placement of the voices quite differently. And the line, "There's someone in my head and it's not me," becomes literally true when you're listening on headphones. But the use of headphones remains controversial, and in a moment we'll continue our conversation about the ear wear, and we'll dig deeper into the history of it. And then later on the program, a conversation with New York producer and tabla player Kirsch Kalay, who has a new album out. Sounds pretty good on headphones. That's coming up later on Soundcheck. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now in our look at headphones, part of our Ear Wars series on hearing and the human ear this week. We've been talking with Virginia Heffernan of the New York Times about her recent column on the argument against headphones. She's here in the studio with me, and on the phone is Mark Katz, author of the book Capturing Sound, How Technology Has Changed Music. And a lot of callers on the line, so why don't we get right to the phones, and Alex is joining us here in New York. Alex, are you? Where are you in the war on headphones?
I'm 60 years old, so I go back to when I had one of those flip-down record players, and I actually had the music shop put a headphone plug on the little flip-down part. Hmm. And of course, I proceeded to walk away and pull the thing right off the shelf. But that was back when I lived in a small apartment with my brother and parents, and you needed to be able to listen to music. You had to have headphones because, forget it, the family couldn't tolerate, you know, all this Beatle music going on at that time. So you had to have headphones. But mm-hmm. I find now that when I do, you know, I have an iPod and I listen on the subway or I listen while I'm walking around, and you're isolated. You
right.
do feel sometimes like you're away from everyone else, and which is fine. I mean, sometimes it's necessary, and it's great. But I also work on 116th Street, and sometimes I come out at night, and I won't wear headphones because, you know, the earbuds, because you want to be aware of what's around you.
Right. Now, Mark, you Virginia mentions this in her article as well, but you mentioned it before, the idea of, you know, aside from whatever it does to your hearing, the social or antisocial aspect of being under pod, as they say, or, you know, under the earphones. How far back does this issue go? I mean, were sociologists in the 50s worried about, you know, people with these newfangled headgears on?
Well, I don't think it goes that far back, because the first real headphones marketed for the home listeners was the Koss headphones, stereo phones, in 1958. Before that, there were amateur radio users, ham radio people, who would isolate themselves with headphones. But really, if you wanted to isolate yourself, you would get your own room. You would get your own. A lot of the times, this was a gendered. It seemed to be fall along gender lines, so you go into your man cave and turn on your stereo and shut out the rest of the family. And in fact, there are lots of cartoons from the 50s and 60s showing just that. But that was a precursor to what we're seeing now, which is definitely accelerating. I walk around on a lot of campuses because I'm a professor, and I see a majority of people with earbuds in their ears, and it's terrible if you want to get directions, because no one wants. Everybody has a go away sign on them.
Virginia, you mentioned, you know, this image, which I had never heard before.
Yes.
The suburban male, middle-aged guy,
yep,
with his headphones as a way of getting away from the wife and kids. You mentioned that in the article.
The so-called womb chair and those giant headphones, you know, that are like massive earmuffs. That certain sociologists have tied this to the development of open-plan living rooms, which must have come to a nightmare to some people coming back from the war. They had been alone with their new radar equipment, and all of a sudden they were in a room meant the family room, so-called family room, an invention of that post-war period, where they were expected to let their wife and kids run around while they listened to or didn't listen to music. So in 58, when those headphones first appeared for personal use, men seized on them. And I remember growing up in the 70s, so many dads in a corner of that family room where they were supposed to be hanging with their kids listening, I remember especially someone listening to Patsy Cline over and over again. And no
well, how
wonder,
do you know? It was on headphones, right?
Well, right. I saw the album on the turntable. But okay. But also no wonder that then Pink Floyd exploits that interiority. So first the thing, and Alex, you know, our caller, I thought did a really nice job illustrating that. He started in a small house. He needed a way to listen to music with his brothers and his mom around. And then it started to feel alienating to him. So the first step is it's wonderful, creates this wonderful interior space, and then suddenly you're getting weird messages from Pink Floyd about how alone you are, and it starts to feel a little weirder.
All right, let's back to the phones. Marie is joining us from Brooklyn. Marie, are you a headphone fan or not so much?
No, I'm afraid I'm pretty strongly against them.
Why?
Several years ago, my ex-husband really damaged his hearing. As the lady on the radio spoke about upper and lower registers, and he was a classical violinist and a tenor, so he was listening to Beethoven. You don't have to listen to Pink Floyd or Ramones or anything, but damage occurred. And I haven't seen him in several years, but as far as I know, it was permanent.
Well,
Halpern spoke of leaves rustling and so on. What if you can't hear a car coming at you?
Yeah.
It can be dangerous.
It's a really good point, and it's not just the hearing loss. Most hearing loss is irreversible. I mean, that's part of the science of it that we've been told all these many years.
You can teach yourself to pick up to pick up cues, which I've been trying to do. But yes, it's irreversible.
Joel Meyer, our producer in the control room, has some comments that people are leaving online. WNYC.org/soundcheck. Joel.
John, our listener Gary from the Upper West Side has this to say about headphones. The health and social costs are huge. Plus, New York is one of the best-sounding cities in the world, and too many people miss the great sounds of the city because they're isolated by their headphones. Gene from New York City writes, I rarely use headphones. I'm 41 years old and just had a hearing test in the past 3 months. The doctor knew that I was not a person that uses headphones based on the better-than-normal test results. And Harvey B. from Manhattan writes this, sort of harking back to an earlier era of headphones. I do hope you'll find the time to discuss what a blessing headphones have been for hearing-impaired persons like myself. I'll always recall the affordable quality headphones that came with the first Sony Walkmans in the 1970s that became, for me, a real life-changer.
Mark, I wanted to ask you about that, the invention of the Sony Walkman, its introduction in 1979, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you know, what is happening, if anything, now that is different from, you know, what my generation listening to a Walkman in the early 1980s would have experienced?
Well, in some ways, it's no different. You're still listening to cheap headphones, walking around and carrying your music. The main difference is that we are now carrying around much, much more music, and we are listening to digital music instead of analog music. Mm-hmm. So the main difference is that you can actually spend more time with your earbuds in, because instead of having to flip it over after 45 minutes at the most, you can listen to 30 days worth of music on your iPod if you want. So the difference is really more to me in degree, except with the one difference, which is earbuds. They didn't have earbuds when the Walkman came out. So now you can really stick the music in your ear, and it's almost like you're injecting music into your head.
You make that sound like a bad thing, Mark.
No. I mean, if you like mainlining music, that's great. But in some ways it is. It really gives you a sense of being inside the music, or the music being inside you.
All right. I want to get to two more quick calls and then ask you guys to help me wrap this up. But Will is joining us from the Lower Hudson Valley. Will, your thoughts on the ear wars, the headphone wars?
Well, I made the point for your screener that there is a major danger with them, because the little speaker in the headphones is very close to your eardrum, and most of the music we listen to today is highly compressed, so
right.
It doesn't get soft and it doesn't get loud. It's all loud. Mm-hmm. because that's commercially advantageous. But the second point I wanted to make, and that's in favor of headphones, is that there's an entire class of recorded music that is designed especially for headphones. The music is recorded using microphones stuck in the ears of little heads, like on a wig shop or something.
So you're talking about like binaural recordings.
Exactly, binaural recordings. And if those are done right and played over good headphones, it's the most extraordinary music reproduction that I've ever heard. And the reason is that if you play back over loudspeakers, the speakers are playing into an acoustic environment, a room with drapes or whatever, which is quite different than the original in which the string quartet or whatever it was playing. And so just the difference in acoustic environment changes things. If you use a binaural recording properly played through good headphones, then that acoustic environment doesn't have any deleterious effect.
Hmm. An interesting just sort of case study. Remember in the mid-1980s, the Bulgarian women's chorus, Against All Odds, became very popular.
Yes.
Had a hit record. We recorded the Bulgarian women at the Church of St. Anne's in Brooklyn in a live concert, and we recorded them binaurally. We actually set up the head in a seat in the front row, and when the women of the chorus came out, there's the audience, and there sitting center in the front row is this big head.
Like a mannequin head?
It's like a mannequin head.
Wow.
And the microphones are where the ears would be, and we had put a scarf around its neck and a cap on its head. And it was probably the creepiest thing they'd ever seen. But it made a great recording. All right, let's take one more call. Andrew from the Bronx. Andrew, which side are you on?
Good afternoon. How are you? I think this is a great subject. I have not read the article. I will get to reading the article. But my question was, what really is considered the most safest for your ear? I mean, whether it be a giant phone that goes over the whole ear or something that goes inside the ear. Because, you know, sometimes when I'm in the train, you've got these people with the things that are inside their ear, but it's, like, so loud, I'm going deaf.
Mm.
Even though it's not in my ear, it's like I'm standing, like, on the other side of the subway car.
And you're still hearing their music.
I'm wondering, like, what is considered, like, an acceptable level? Because, I mean, I don't wear earphones, but if I could find out what would be maybe the most acceptable level, like, I might purchase that piece of technology. Like, I might even get, like, an iPod. I mean, I live in a home with no TV, no computer. I listen to my WNYC, and I'm a monthly sustainer.
Well, Andrew, you need to be listening to our Soundcheck Smackdown tomorrow.
No, I do.
When
I
we will
24/7.
We will address.
I never turn the station. I never turn it on.
We will address this very question: which is safer, earbuds going into the ear canal or headphones that go over the ear? And just, I mean, Virginia, do you, your call is specifically against headphones. Do you include earbuds in that?
Earbuds would be public enemy number one. Supraoral, the bigger, the better. The more old-fashioned they look, the better. Wear them walking down the street. Embrace them as, you know, part of your winter uniform. If you must wear headphones, the headphones that go around the ears, not on your ears, and certainly not in your ears.
All right, Mark, do you agree?
I think generally that's good, but you should, whatever you use, you should have the volume low enough so that you can hear your surroundings too.
Mark Katz is author of the book Capturing Sound: How Technology Has Changed Music. Virginia Heffernan is author of the article Against Headphones in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, where she writes the Medium column, and they've both been with us to kick off the Ear Wars this week on Soundcheck. Virginia, Mark, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, Kersh Kale tells us about his work joining the cultural heritage of India with the musical heritage of the West. That's next on Soundcheck.